You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning and welcome to The View. I'm so glad you could join us today. I am the Reverend Joanna Fontaine Crawford, and I'm here in Austin, Texas, where it is nice and cool, so I'm trying to enjoy it because, man, I know that summer heat and summer bugs and summer are all on their way. And today we are talking to transgender UU religious professionals, and we have with us the Reverend Michael Slack, Reverend Anya Johnston, and Zeister Alex Capitan. And I have a little bit of information. Let's see. I see that Michael is Director of Congregational Life at Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Raleigh, founder and director of For Life, an ecumenical consultative ministry associated with metropolitan community churches that works with communities of faith to be more welcoming and inclusive of people of all sexual orientations and gender identities, and a member of Trust. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Let me just ask that. Trust. Okay, and we will. Yeah. I am going to be asking them for more information about that. And Alex is a member of the Trust Steering Committee and was previously on staff for the UA National Office. So welcome. I'm so glad that you could join us today. So first question, so what's Trust?
How about first question, Anya, can you introduce yourself a little bit too, since Joanna didn't have an introduction for you?
Yeah, I'm at an undisclosed location near Portland, Oregon. And I haven't been working for a few years, so I don't have the usual now serving such and so. But until 2012, I was I specialized in transitional ministries. Since 1994, and I just kind of love the absurdity of it being transitional ministries and a transitions office and a trans minister.
And you're also on the Trust Steering Committee.
Have been for a while.
So, what is Trust?
Do you want to go first, Anya, since you've been part of the leadership longest?
Okay. Trust was started essentially by the Reverend's Barb Grieve and Sean Bennison to bring together transgender Unitarian Universalist professionals of both educational leaders and ministerial leaders to find out how we can possibly exist within an association such as the UUA. And it's been in formation for a long time, and we would get together and we would have our phone conferences and we would gather at General Assembly, and that's about it until last month. So the rest of that will unfold, but in short, it's essentially a support group for transgender professionals.
And you said things changed last month, and I know there was an event. Can someone tell us a little bit about that?
Alex.
Yeah. Yeah, go for it, Alex.
So last month was a historic occasion, just a couple weeks ago, really, of the first time that we were able to have a retreat for trans UU religious professionals. This had been a dream of the founders, Barb Grieve and Sean Parker Dennison, since they founded Trust. And Trust was born in 2004 after several years of conversation between the two of them as folks who were really being thrust into the spotlight in terms of UU religious professionals. People kept referring them to each other, saying, hey, you should really talk to Barb, and hey, you should really talk to Sean, as if they weren't, you know, best friends already. And so 2004, they decided to create an organization so that, you know, all UU trans religious professionals could have a community and start to be able to advocate for our needs within this denomination. So some of the things they've been able to focus on over the past 12 years has been trainings for the Ministerial Fellowship Committee and other credentialing bodies, partnerships with UUMA and LAREDA, our two professional organizations for ministers and directors of religious education, and so on. But they really wanted to have a retreat where all UU religious professionals who are trans could come together and, you know, form community together, build community together, support each other, talk about our struggles within this denomination and our needs. And so that's what we were able to do last month, thanks to a generous grant from the UU funding program and a matching grant from the UUA national office. And 15 of us gathered. That's not all of us. There are probably twice as many of us out there, if not more, but those were the folks who were able to be there. And also, given the historic nature of this first event of this nature, there was a sort of sense that everyone who was present needed to be fully public about being trans or genderqueer or two-spirit or gender nonconforming or intersex and, you know, trans in some other way. And, you know, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to keep people safe. So it was a fabulous time. We spent 3 days together, 3.5 days. Kate Bornstein was our facilitator. And for folks who don't know Kate, she is one of the real elders within our community and a spiritual mentor to many of us. Although she doesn't identify as Unitarian Universalist, she's definitely a kindred spirit. So that was fabulous. And we were also joined by Sarah Lammert, Director of Ministries and Faith Development for the UUA National Office, and Janice Marie Johnson, Multicultural Leadership, Multicultural Ministries and Leadership Director for the UUA National Office. So that was fabulous as well. We were able to sort of talk about our needs and directly deliver those needs to representatives of the National Office. What else would you all share, Michael and Anya?
One of the things that I thought was really beautiful about that experience was just weeks before I had been able to participate in Finding Our Way Home, which is an opportunity for UU religious professionals of color and seminarians to get together and to support one another and share space in a way that we don't ordinarily get a chance to. And it was my first Finding Our Way Home, but two folks who are sort of representing Finding Our Way Home, Rosemary Bray McNatt and also Sophia Betancourt, came and led worship that first day, that first full day, as a way to sort of represent sort of their hopes for us as a new cohort getting together for the first time in that way. It was really meaningful and beautiful, and they were able to share some of the things that were initially really beautiful and hard about Finding Our Way Home coming together for the first time, however many years ago, and sort of passing those hopes on to us. It was really, really incredible for me to have been a part of Finding Our Way Home for the first time and then to sort of bear witness to this sort of passing... passing on the torch in a way. So that was really excellent. And also it was really beautiful just to know who many of us are. You know, we're kind of spread out all over the country, and to be able to share meals together and laugh together and cry together and all the things that we were able to do was really healing for me. So I was really excited to be a part of it.
And Anya, did you have any, were you there?
I certainly was, although I almost wasn't. Sean and Barb had to talk me into it because I'd more or less given up.
And then I decided that would be the week that I would decide whether I could even still be a Unitarian Universalist or not. And it was transformational and amazing. Partly, as Michael was saying, well, the laughing and crying together, those were both in extremes. It was poignant in a way to see that many of us together and see a little more suffering than I expected in the rest of the population, and ultimately a lot more promise than I had been feeling for a while. And both Janice and Sarah were a big part of that because of their attentiveness to us and their listening. So it was huge in that way. And the history, I'm just going to simplify. I don't actually identify as a trans female or trans woman, but just to stick with a comfortable binary for people, trans women have had a very poor experience as leaders in the Unitarian Universalist Association. And it was good to know that I wasn't the only one. I'm the only one who ever worked in a parish. But yeah, I just didn't feel so alone anymore, which I guess is what a group like that can do when we're spread out all over the place. So, yeah.
We often talk about the need to make safe spaces. Was this, for y'all, was this a safe space?
I certainly treated it as one. Because of the internal pressure to need to make decisions, I also felt the need to take risks, and that was hard. I will say that there were people who were it was so intense for them, they had to remove themselves several times, which is the suffering that I was alluding to. I thought I had it bad, and maybe at some levels I have at least as much, but I never had to get up and walk out. So there's a lot of pain there, and it was a place where people could acknowledge that even if they couldn't stay in the room. To me, on the way home after it all, I realized that trust has the potential to be of great use to our colleagues, more, let's just say, in a pastoring and mentoring way, more than was clear before, because it's now, we've now all been in the room.
So, Anya, you kind of alluded to this, but I'll open this question up for everyone. What are the challenges in being a trans UU religious professional?
Well, one of the things that that really stuck out for me that I know I feel and I was really able to hear other people express, in particularly in that setting, was this sense that folks really rely on you. Folks rely on you to understand all of the things and to be able to communicate all of who you are and all of who the entire trans and gender nonconforming world is, in a way that's not really realistic, and in a way that creates stress and can do harm, honestly. You know, I heard more than one person in that room say, I'm not here to be the trans UU that everyone knows and calls upon. Like, I'm not here to be an activist. I'm not here to do that work. I'm here to be a minister. I'm here to serve in the ways that I was called to serve. And yet, this weight is placed upon me. I heard that so many times from people. And I think that it makes it, our work as ministers as ministerial leaders, as spiritual leaders, has its own stressors, and we can all sort of understand what some of those stressors are as religious professionals. But to add on top of that, the weight of being relied upon to answer all the questions and do all the things, if that is not the work that you're called to do, that makes it incredibly difficult to do our work in any meaningful way. And yet, that is often the expectation, that if you're trans and somebody knows it, then suddenly you're the one that everyone is calling on to do all the things. And it can make you feel really alone, and especially given how spread out we are all over the country, it's hard to get the support that people need. And especially if there's no broader institutional support, it makes it that much harder.
I'll say that one thing that is really apparent to me as a trans religious professional is something that is common to all folks with marginalized identities, particularly folks with multiple marginalized identities within our movement, which is, as someone who's done a lot of welcome and inclusion work around all sorts of intersections of identity and experience within Unitarian Universalism, what's really common is having congregations and other groups of Unitarian Universalists out there sort of being theoretically okay and excited about diversity in terms of, hey, you know, we have this identity as being a really welcoming and inclusive place, and we really want that identity to be visually reflected. We want to be able to look around and see we are accomplishing our mission of being welcoming and inclusive by virtue of the diversity of people who are in this room, or, you know, whatever room it is, right? Even if it's a virtual room. But the truth is, we have a very difficult time transforming our culture so that people with marginalized identities actually get their spiritual needs met and have the ability to bring their full selves forward in that room. So what we often see is, what I often see when I do educational work and organizing work in our UU contexts is, and I'm sure lots of people listening to this can relate to this, is if you are like us in every single way, except for one. For example, if you are, you know, if you reflect the same sorts of identities and experiences as everybody else in this room, or the assumption is that everybody has the same sorts of identities and experiences, except you happen to be partnered with someone of a different gender, then it's okay, because you can still like blend enough with the existing culture that we have. But when you start to have multiple marginalized identities, whether it's because you're both trans and queer, or because you are a person of color and you have a disability, you can't actually fit into the existing culture if that culture is a dominant culture, is a mainstream culture, right? We actually require transformation in order to be able to be present. And that's true for all trans people. But when you start looking at trans religious professionals, whoa, like, you know, watch out if someone comes in into a leadership position in a congregation and says, look, I can't actually be your leader unless you are willing to be transformed, unless you are willing to allow me to bring forward my transformational potential in this context, which is sort of what we have to be able to do as spiritual leaders, right? And like I said, this is not specific to trans folk. This is a deep matter of faith, is are we willing to be transformed so that we are a space in which all people are able to come, bring their full selves, and get their spiritual needs met, and bring forward their spiritual gifts in the process, right? And we haven't quite figured that out yet as a religion. We're in good company. Lots of other religions haven't figured it out either, right? But, you know, it's the reason why I feel like I became a religious professional, because I feel called to help congregations, especially UU congregations and other groups within UUism, do that transformation. And the reason is because I can't find a church where I can actually get my spiritual needs met within this religion, even though I was raised as a Unitarian Universalist. But because I'm queer and trans, because I'm a young adult, because I was raised UU, all of these things come together to mean I can't find a home in this religion unless we are willing to transform ourselves.
One of my dreams is that we stop saying we're radically inclusive until we even begin to understand it's an aspiration, because it genuinely makes me crazy. And especially when I move, I'm in Seattle 3 years, and the PNWD, I came here with, you know, glitter and rainbows, and we are so radically inclusive, and it was like a punch in the face, because no, y'all aren't. And, you know, so yes to everything you said, and until we can say we aspire to radical inclusivity, but we genuinely don't know what that means. And I think diversity and inclusion, when I hear that in our context, I think of Princess Bride. I don't think those words mean what you think they mean. So it's an aspiration.
Well, and I think it's also a verb, right? I think we have a tendency to use these words as if they're nouns, as if they're name tags and badges that we can just wear and say, look, I'm an ally. I'm welcoming. You know, we are the perfect church because we are fill in the blank, when actually we have to understand that these are spiritual practices. We can practice the spiritual practice of radical inclusion, but we have to understand that it's a practice. It's a verb. It's not
Amen.
Something we automatically are. And it means that we're going to get messy. It's going to be uncomfortable.
That's right.
And it has to be.
That's
Otherwise,
right.
we're not being transformed.
And we also have to, I think, recognize that it requires some level of comfort with being uncomfortable. We have to be willing to be uncomfortable, and we have to be willing to be uncomfortable together in order to learn some new things, in order to get past the stuff that we're concerned about, afraid of, uncertain of, you know, don't have knowledge around. We can't know all the things, but we can be in relationship with all the people, right? And it's that being in relationship piece that I think gets really tricky, because it requires sort of looking beyond your own lens. And as a religious professional, you know, that's something that we kind of are trying to live every day and hope for in the congregations that we serve, and that we live out and hope and invite for other people to live out. And in some ways, that's not what not all of us are called to do that and be that. And so it really requires the work on the part of the congregations to really take that time and to struggle, and it does take time. That's the other piece. You know, doing a workshop around these issues isn't often enough. 2-hour workshop doesn't do it. It calls on us to do quite a bit more and for quite a bit longer. And again, like Alex said, it's a spiritual practice. It's something that we are called to do every single day. It's hard work, and it's worth doing.
Michael, you had kind of alluded to this earlier. For a trans religious professional, what is the significance of exhaustion? Because it sounds like that's a big part of your reality.
It can be. It can be, certainly. You know, on some level, we're called to do whatever that work is that we're called to do, whether we're religious professionals or ministers or people who were called to be out in the world bearing witness, whatever that work is, you know, finding the support that we need can sometimes be hard. But also having to go into spaces that aren't quite moving in the directions that we hope that the world can continue to move in is rough. It's rough to face that every day. And I think one of the things that the retreat did, certainly did for me, was to allow me to just take a lot of deep breaths and put my shoulders down a bit. And that doesn't happen on a regular basis for all of us, for many of us, I think.
There, of course, in the news, there's been, you know, a lot of recent anti-trans legislation, such as HB2. How are trans people doing?
You know, specifically around HB2, folks are tired. You know, a number of us are sort of in the process of building and creating new spiritual community here in Durham called The Clearing, and we sort of set up some space on Monday, April 25th, when opening session happened in North Carolina, at the General Assembly. And, you know, it was just a space for people to come and rest and to not be in the mix of all of the things. And the one word that I consistently heard from people who stopped by were, the phrase was, I'm tired. You know, people are just exhausted. It is exhausting to stand in the face of that kind of hatred and active misunderstanding, you know, just a lack of, an unwillingness to understand and be educated around lived experiences that aren't your own. It's rough. It's really rough. And there's a lot of work happening on the ground. There's a lot of work happening legislatively. There's work happening in the courts right now. There are a number of different strategies being implemented, and they're all really important. And it's tiring. You know, I want to be able to live my life in the best possible ways that I can and be supported in all the ways that I need and hope to be supported. And to have a legislature with very little understanding of trans issues, if any at all, legislate around my life and other people's lives is it's emotionally and spiritually debilitating.
What can congregations do to be more supportive of trans and gender nonconforming communities, especially the ones that are in the areas where these initiatives are being put into motion? And I will say, I'm asking that not only in a theoretical way, but in Texas, our legislature meets every 2 years. And so we get a break this year, but we know that they're all gearing up for this sort of thing.
You know, I will say it, and I'd love to hear from Anya and Alex about this too. But the one thing that I keep saying is that we all have a responsibility in this moment, whether you're a part of religious community or not, to understand lived experiences beyond your own. You know, I think one of the biggest struggles that folks have had over this last month and a half is that folks don't understand what's happening. They don't understand why this legislation is damaging. They don't understand the rhetoric that's being thrown out into the world. And it's because maybe you don't think you've ever talked to a trans person. You don't understand anything about gender identity, or you haven't asked those questions. You haven't really engaged the concept of gender in a deeper way. And I think folks have a responsibility to do that. More in some ways, and maybe I'll get into some trouble for saying this, but even more than going out and with your signs and protesting in the streets, that's great, and that's a very public representation of what matters to you in the world. I think that's wonderful, and those things are really important and empowering for everybody who's involved. But also, sit in a room for a while and talk about gender, talk about gender identity, understand all of the ways in which we can experience and express our gender. Because I think that's the stuff that will ultimately make the biggest change.
I would add to that, I completely agree with everything that Michael just said, and I would also add to it, you know, just to reiterate that this is about relationships.
That's right.
And it's about forming relationships, getting in relationship, mm-hmm. valuing relationships, not writing off people in your life or on your Facebook feed because they're saying something that is a little off base, engaging with that off base. If you have the ability to have some breathing space, that means that you have the ability to take some weight off of those of us who can't handle having one more conversation with somebody about this, right? So you might feel like you don't have all the right language or you don't really know, you know, the best things to say, but like everyone is needed in this struggle, whether it's about gender, whether it's about race, whether it's about economic justice, you know, being able to actually have those relationships, engage in those relationships. Because what we're seeing with this anti-trans legislation, we all know that this is backlash against gay stuff, whether it's marriage, whether it's anything else. The religious right and conservative politicians, the very extreme, you know, wings of those movements, they're using this as a wedge issue. This isn't about trans people. This isn't about Anya and Michael and me. We don't have faces in this struggle. This is about mobilizing a base in terms of trying to reclaim, right, political space when obviously the space has been very dominated by this rhetoric for a very long time. But it's a mobilizing issue. So what's really needed is for those of us who are liberal religious folk, we need to actually be able to stand up in the public sphere and reclaim the term religion, reclaim the term spirit, and say, look, the religious right doesn't speak for us, that our religious values teach us X, teach us love, teach us being able to, you know, extend a hand to folks who are most marginalized. Whatever our values are able to help us understand, this battle is not going to be won in the secular realm. We are needed as people of faith to be able to say, no, these are our siblings. These are our people. This is our communities that we're talking about. And we need white people to talk to white people. We need straight people to be talking to straight people. Because when we have some sort of valued or dominant or mainstream identity, then we have access to conversations that other folks don't have access to. This isn't just about bathroom bills and trans people. This is about Trump, right? Right. Right. We want to actually, because, you know, and it's really, it's hard for a lot of us, obviously, whose lives are on the line. This isn't just rhetoric. This isn't just about, you know, whatever, buzzwords and stuff like that. I have a housemate who came downstairs the other day and said, I don't know if I can vote for Hillary if she gets the nomination. So she's a super, super Bernie fan. I'm a super, super Bernie fan. But I stared at her. And I was like, you understand that people's lives are on the line, right? You're going to not vote because you don't like Hillary as much as you like Bernie? Like, I don't know who's going to get the nomination. Whatever, it's not important. What's important is stopping the rhetoric of hate, no matter whose mouth it's coming out of, right? And being able to understand that this isn't just about, you know, confusing political maneuverings. This is about people's lives because, you know, that's ultimately what's going to happen, regardless of whether something is constitutional or not. It's probably not. But in the meanwhile, in the years that it's going to take to get a bill defeated in the courts, people are going to be dying, or at least unable to live out their lives because of the ways in which this then, you know, snowballs, and the ways in which it condones hate. So...
Michael, you've worked with metropolitan community churches. Do you feel that we need more formal ways of across the denominations gathering to brainstorm, to figure out what we can do as, you know, blocks of religious people?
I think that can be meaningful. I would actually really love to see across denominations people talking about all of the various issues that are at play here. You know, one of the things that folks were trying to do, and honestly I think in many ways succeeded at doing, was using the issue of bathrooms to mask the fact that there are some really awful things in this law that don't have anything to do with bathrooms. You know, local governments are no longer able to increase the minimum wage as a result of that law. It limited local control in that way, and that affects all people. And so we have to be able, I think, to recognize the ways in which we are all being impacted, and come together around all of those various issues. You know, sometimes in our social justice movements, we focus on one piece, and ultimately, in only focusing on that one piece, it's easy to become divisive because, well, what about, you know, what about veterans' rights in this bill? What about minimum wage issues in this bill? What about the fact that people are now substantially limited in state courts to file discrimination claims? Like, that impacts all of us, and it requires us to sort of reach across our various issues to come together. And I think we can do that across denominations. And I also think that sometimes that's too big for folks. You know, sometimes we need to really slow things down and work locally. One of the things that has been really hard to watch, it's probably been one of the most difficult things to witness in all of this, is that the folks who are really on the ground doing all the local work, the folks who were sitting on the street in civil disobedience in front of the governor's house, for example, you know, there are national organizations that are coming in and aren't really talking to people locally until the final hour. It's like there need to be some, we have to figure out some better ways to communicate with one another, to work together. You know, national organizations often have big nonprofit money, right, in a way that smaller local organizations don't. And that has an impact on the folks locally that we don't talk about nearly as much. And so I feel like that is a place where we need to broaden our level of communication and understanding, not just denominationally, but also who are we talking to and why are we talking to those folks as opposed to other folks. You know, like, we really need to ask these hard questions and think about these things, because it's the folks who, you know, who were sitting on the street in front of the governor's house the night of the bill passage. Those are the folks who were getting arrested. Those are the folks who were the most marginalized, and no one was having conversations with them, and they're doing the work and putting their lives on the line. You know, whereas bigger entities can come in and do their work and then leave. Right? And so I think there's a lot of work that we can do just in terms of how different organizations and entities are working together, and really engaging each other and understanding the various strategies that we can implement to get these kinds of laws repealed. You know, I think HB2 will be, I think something's going to happen. It'll either happen in the courts or there'll be a repeal. I believe that. I have to have faith in that. right? But it's going to take some relationship building. It is all about relationships. And, you know, we can learn science and math and history all day long, but when are we sitting down and talking about how we build relationships and how to do that in a healthy and healing way?
What's it like down in the trenches in these areas with these initiatives?
It's draining, and it's hard, and it feels like there's no end in sight, you know? But folks are figuring out ways to take care of ourselves and each other along the way. It's rough. It's, you know, it's not just rough here, you know. And it hasn't just become rough, right? Like, you know, there's a voting rights law that was passed here that was unconscionable. But nobody was talking about that. People are really struggling around those issues. There's all kinds of stuff going on. Where the most marginalized folks are not getting what they need and their voices aren't being heard. This isn't the first time this has happened, and it won't be the last if we don't figure out ways to mobilize and come together.
I'd like to just point out, though, that, you know, just out, off of your question, Joanna, that I think as someone who lives in the North, there's a tendency to think, oh, that's a Southern problem. Mm-hmm. And I want to just push back and make sure that if there's anyone listening who's thinking that, that's absolutely not true.
Absolutely not true.
Also, not only is it not just a Southern problem, or it's certainly not something in which anyone should feel like you can stand on any kind of horse and say, oh, well, people are just really backwards in such and such a place, because that's not what this is about whatsoever. Oppression is manifesting itself everywhere. It just takes different forms, and it looks different. But the other thing I want to point out is that the resilience of our people in the states in which these, you know, these huge, hugely problematic bills are coming forward is some of the most amazing resilience and organizing and, you know, community building, family building that exists. So, you know, like, there's a lot of different sides to the coin, but it's not a simple thing whatsoever to think, oh, you know, this is only happening in such and such a place, and oh, those poor people who live there, right? Like, that's not what this is at all.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I will say certainly, the level of support and love within queer and trans people of color communities down here in North Carolina is fierce. It is fierce, and it is magnificent, and I don't know that I've ever seen or experienced anything like it before. And that is something that I feel like I wouldn't necessarily have felt or received in the same ways up north, which is really interesting, right? Like, folks were all worried about, you know, and I had people who were really close who love me and care about my family were like, oh my gosh, are you going to be okay moving down to North Carolina as a person of color? And I was like, are you kidding? Like, this is going to be magnificent in all the ways that it has been. in terms of queer and trans people of color really coming together to support each other and care for each other and be magical together and to just do remarkable things. So it's complex and it's multifaceted. Yes, it is hard to bear witness to how awful all of this is for so many people, and yet we are incredibly resilient and caring for each other in all the ways that we can figure out how to be creative around that in the midst of all of the ugliness.
It was there was experience like this in the 90s. It was a different issue then. When trans wasn't the issue, but gay rights was, and the ability to talk about to use the word homosexual in a public school. And in Idaho, this is what cemented my connection to Unitarian Universalism, was the campaign against that initiative, which would be equivalent to arguing against HB2 now. Oregon had the same initiative going at the time. They all came out of the Briggs Initiative in California, which contributed to Harvey Milk's murder and other things. And that all came out of Anita Bryant's hate campaign. And that essentially came out of witch trials in Salem. It's all the same thing, where it's never about witches or gay marriage or trans bathrooms. It's always about building a coalition of people who are all afraid of the same things. And the fear is always nebulous. So the question about what we can do in congregations, in our Unitarian Universalist identities, reminds me of Portland's experience then in 94 of their hate-free zone, of tying a giant ribbon around their entire city block. And for one thing, it brought the church back to life. And it also, the often vaunted phrase, we want to be a beacon of liberal religious thought or some such thing. That's another one of those words that doesn't really mean much. So how are you being a beacon? Well, in the face of that hateful environment, that congregation and many others, including Boise, where I was, just made a public show of, look, see, right here, it's a safe place to be. To go back to that, was it a safe space? Well, it got me into the denomination. And I wasn't identifying as anything other than happily married parent at that time. I ended up in seminary, and everywhere I served, as I came out as trans, as I started dealing with that on my own, the congregations were fine. They were excited. They were proud. With the exception always of two or three people who carried the hate for the whole group, and they carried the labels that you would hate to hear, the it. They call us it. They call us that creature. They do that sort of thing. And it's 1 or 2%. What we could do is, Under the challenge of that initiative, we formed a huge coalition in Idaho of different religions, and the Unitarian Universalists were a big part of that. And we defeated that initiative because those people, not just leaders, but people in the congregations got together. We did the public things, the visible things that you see, the initiatives that the on the street corner with the signs. These are important things just to let the world know where you stand, literally where you stand. But the power came not from the leaders, it came from the members of different faith communities who would get together and agree that that kind of oppression, that kind of marginalization, that kind of hate and fear was not congruent with their faith, or with their need to be decent humans. And our congregations, whether they have buildings or not, have the ability to be those communities where that interaction happens, where the relationships are built. It's happened before.
I know it's happening now. Right now, we're in the spotlight as trans people, and it's just like with all the others, it's not really about us, but we're being used. Our identity is being used to build hate. We've forgotten a few things, as people do over the decades, and we go back and we start over instead of picking up with the skills we already have. There's so much we can do. There's so much potential to be strong and influential and not have to be the star. Our strength comes not from our huge numbers, because we don't have huge numbers. It comes from our solid grounding in a faith tradition that doesn't have room for that kind of hatred. And we have to be careful not to start hating also.
Right.
Anya, can I ask you, can I jump in? Because you had said in the beginning that the trust retreat would determine whether or not you would even stay Unitarian Universalist. And if you're comfortable, I'd love to hear where you are now with that.
There's a map of the country on my wall here with little spots on it where I might go to work in congregations. And specifically, it was Sarah Lammert who reopened the door I don't want to get into all the details of why, because it sounds so passive to say they wouldn't let me work, but essentially they said, I'm sorry, being trans is too hard, you need to take several years off. So there I was. I couldn't get out of my sabbatical. So I've had a very, very long sabbatical, and the timing was perfect for Sarah to be there and to listen. I get by in life by letting an optimist survive inside me. So that retreat fed that optimist and convinced me that, yeah, there's hope. And since that day, that last day of the retreat, people have commented that I'm talking as if I'm included. And apparently that hasn't happened for many years. That same kind of joyful transformation can happen for anyone who feels marginalized and walks in one of our doors. It just hadn't happened for me in a long, long time.
I know we only have a few minutes left, but what can UU congregations do to increase inclusion, affirmation, and advocacy of and for trans people in their congregations?
Well, I'll say, as someone who managed the Welcoming Congregation program for several years, I had the blessing of being able to engage with this question quite a lot, particularly because a lot of our congregations went through that program. They might have gone through that program 10, 15 years ago, which is fabulous, maybe even 20 years ago. And for congregations that went through that program, particularly those who went through it early on, there can sometimes be a sense that we've been there, done that, right? Like, we're totally welcoming and inclusive now in terms of LGBTQ, right, or LGBT or BGLT or whatever acronym folks like to use, when in fact the sand is shifting. The sand is always shifting. The words that I use to describe myself did not exist 15 years ago. It's that real, right? Like, when I was born, the language had not yet been invented for me to describe who I am. So having gone through a program, an intentional program, around increasing welcome and inclusion of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people 15 or 20 years ago, or even 5 years ago, everything might have changed in 5 years. There's turnover in the congregation. The language has changed. The youth are using words that you have no idea what they mean. So the idea, and this goes along with what I was saying earlier, the idea it has to be that welcome is a spiritual practice. Welcome is a verb. It's not a noun. It's not a static identity. Ally is not an identity. It's a verb. It's something that we do. And in order to do it, we have to practice it. And so to practice it, it involves constantly looking around and saying, who's not at the table, or for those of people who are at the table, who's feeling like it's not their table, like Anya was just speaking to. You know, who built this table, and who issued the invitations, and who has literally had to wrestle their way to get here, and then they got here, and they're not even sure if they can have a seat, a place to be at this table. And it's not just about, you know, training your membership folks and your ushers and your greeters, although that's very important, right? It's not just the role of two people on a Sunday morning. It's everyone's job to try to be looking around and saying, how can we create this space in a more inclusive way? How can we open our door even wider? And it's about religious education. It's about worship. It's about your justice ministries. It's about, you know, the policies and procedures, particularly around membership and finances and money, because that gets into all kinds of stuff, right? And when I say religious education, I mean religious education for all ages as well. I think we often have, when I talk to folks, I think there's often this sense that the mythical trans person is someone who's A, not here yet, and B, going to walk through the door on a Sunday morning and we're going to be able to recognize that they are trans. And we're going to be able to specifically welcome them, right? When in fact, A, you can't tell who's trans. B, there's probably already trans people in your congregation. C, what about our kids? We're raising trans kids and not even knowing it. And do we actually create a space where those children can get the full experience and be able to bring themselves in full to church on whatever day of the week they come? And it's not just about trans kids. It's about all of our kids. Because do we want to be raising young boys who are able to be sensitive and emotional and feminist? And do we want to raise young girls who are able to be independent and strong and fierce? Yes, I hope so, right? So we have to help all of everyone in our congregation. We have to be able to help them unpack what they've been taught about gender and about how that's kept them small, how that's kept all of us from being able to be our full selves. So that's sort of what I say when I get this question. And I'm also excited to share that Michael and I are in the process of starting a collective that's going to be helping congregations do this very work. We're interested in helping congregations deepen their inclusion and their welcome and live out that radical welcome in all dimensions, engaging with that real culture shift and transformation that we talked about earlier in terms of gender, sexuality, race, class, ability, and more. So if you're interested in doing this work, I hope that you'll get in touch with one or both of us because we'd love to help and be of service in that way.
That's right.
Great. How should they get in touch with you?
Well, you can email me at alexleekapitan@gmail.com. Or you can email Michael.
And you can email me at mykal.sack@gmail.com.
Great. Thank y'all very much for being on. I want to note that today is a double feature for The View. At 5 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have an episode live from the Economic Sustainability Summit, which will be live from 24 Farnsworth. And The View crew meets with attendees of the UUA Sustainability Summit, and it will be hosted by Tom Shade and Bob LaValle, and we hope that y'all can make that. Thank you very much for being on the show. I know that we could continue talking for about 5 hours.
It is
greatly appreciated that you were willing to come on and share your stories and give some information that I think will be very helpful for many congregations. I'm definitely thinking about, okay, how can we, you know, like ally hard, you know, commit to this.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.